Thank you, Daniel. That was beautiful, wonderful. So it's my honor now to introduce our guest speaker, who is Nipun Mehta. And I've done guest speaking in Nipun's organization. He's done it in this organization. And we have this long history of humiliating each other with compliments. So today is no exception. Rather than speak too long, because I have so many compliments for Nipun and so much praise for him, because he really has made a huge difference in my life and in the life of this community, I thought I would read a poem that was posted on the service-based website by a woman that I met at the Awaken Circle, Jyoti. You probably are familiar with this. And it goes like this. She starts off by explaining it. An on-the-cuff remark made by Bonnie Rose during her talk at the Awaken Circle stuck with me. She said, you guys are quite radical. It is very Nipun-esque, referring to something she had solved, perhaps by thinking about what would Nipun do. I'm still thinking about what is Nipun-esque. And here's what I came up with. Smile for no reason at all. Give just because one can. In a world of mistrust and fear, be courageous enough to be kind. Listen really intently. Remember it all. Celebrate joys. Trust to amplify them. Notice every act of kindness anyone does and thank them for it. Then tell others about it. Out the quietly kind ones. Believe there are many. Gather and connect them at home and abroad, in person and virtually, virtuously. Tell stories. Laugh. Sit in silence. Welcome strangers, stay open and curious, do the dishes, work tirelessly. There's a lot of work to be done. Involve whoever wants to work, but expect nothing. Hug often, and don't forget the key, practice random acts of kindness. There is a whole lot more if I was to think of what would Nipun do, such as interviewing spiritual gurus, cooking for monks at the local monastery, taking pilgrimages, reading, writing, giving TED Talks, hosting retreats, creating technology with a clear vision for bettering humanity, soundbite mantras to convey crucial principles, and a million other things. But I am only focusing on Nipun-esque for what I can learn to practice. What is Nipun-esque for you? And so it is. It's my honor to welcome Nipun Mehta. Let's give him lots of love.
Thank you. I'm going to have to work harder to embarrass Bonnie. Next time, you're in trouble. Let's see. Bonnie, what's your password? Oh, I got it, Bonnie. Everybody knows now. You got that on tape, yeah? Anyways, Google's listening to everything, so it's okay. Well, what a joy to be here. Since the last time I was here, there's been a new sign that's up there, and what a glorious sign, be love, share love, and serve love. I feel like I'm home when I come here, because there's so many wonderful old friends and so many kindred spirits. Yesterday I was at another event yesterday morning, and I spoke about compassion, generosity, love, empathy, all that kind of good stuff, right? And then I asked this question. This can tell you how effective I'm going to be. I asked everybody, how many of you think we're fundamentally selfish, and how many think we're fundamentally selfless? Selfish with a few moments of selflessness, and selfless with a few moments of, you know, self-centeredness. 50-50. I've done it with kids. 50-50. And that's the world that we live in. It didn't just happen overnight. It didn't just happen because of one generation or one series of technologies or one set of problems. But when I come here, I feel a lot of hope, because here, I don't even need to do that survey here, because I know where it's going to tilt. Right? I can imagine, because we're here at the center of love. So thank you for holding that space in yourself. I want to share about compassion. Every time I come here also, I have to always, I don't know why it happens to me here, but you sing that song, I Am Remembering Who I Am. It just, there's always this tear that comes out, and then I'm always here when I'm speaking, so I'm like, oh, wait, Nipun, stop, you have to speak. But it just moves me. And it's very interesting if you think about I'm remembering who I am, because sometimes it takes time to remember who you are. So you need to have a lot of patience. I was talking with a friend of mine who's a school teacher, and we were talking about how do you teach compassion. And she says, you know, I don't think you can teach compassion. You have to grow compassion. And to grow compassion, you cannot say, I've planted the seeds, there's sunshine, I'm watering it. You can't say, it's Thursday, where's my cucumber? It arises when the time ripens. It arises when the time ripens. You have to do your job, but then you have to wait. And I said, oh, that sounds great, but how do you practice that in your school? She was a principal of a school. She says, well, you know, I was in a classroom one time. She gave me this example. And she says, there were kids, you know, misbehaving sometimes, not sticking with the program. And so I saw this one kid, and we're telling everybody, okay, everybody go over to that side. You know, and people are pumped up. They're going there. And there's this one kid who's like, no, I don't care. And he's got his hands down, and he's like looking down on the ground, not even looking up at the teacher. She says, I could have used force and tried to discipline, but I remembered my principle of waiting. And so I just watched. And I noticed that as I looked a little closer, he was paying attention to these ants that were crawling on the ground. I was like, okay, well, that's a kind of education too. And I waited and I watched. And as I watched, I noticed that a little bit later, someone else was passing through that pathway, and they were about to step on that ant, and he says, no, 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 there are ants here. And I said, wow, this kid could actually be, I don't need to punish him, I actually need to have him teach other people. And I said, so I was just being a little devil's advocate, I said, that sounds like, that's a cute story, that's wonderful, right? But what happens if somebody's doing something dramatic where you can't wait? What happens when somebody's bullying? And she says, well, that's happened. And I said, what do you mean? And she goes on to tell me this story. She works with an integrated classroom, so people who are differently abled are integrated with people who are traditionally abled. And so she puts them all together, and that can create all kinds of dynamics. So they had this one kid who was cognitively challenged in the same classroom, but because he was cognitively challenged, he was, you know, he's a lot bigger. And so every so often he would get angry and he starts punching other kids. He starts beating other kids. He says, what to do? I'm a principal. I have a principle of, you know, I have this understanding of waiting for the cucumbers to arise, right? But wow, am I just going to let this happen? I have to do something. What do you do? So she goes up to that child, stops him the first time, and says, you know, when you hit that other child, how does it feel? And the child says, it feels great. She goes and teaches the other kids, look, when he does that, you don't strike back anger with anger. You hold the hand, and you just wait until the anger subsides. So she teaches them how to be in that situation. But she says every time this guy started to hurt other people in the classroom, she would go up to the child and she would say, how did it feel? And the child every time would say, it felt great. Punch again, it felt great. Punch again, it felt great. Until 2 months later, one fine day, he hesitates. And he says, I'm not sure. That's the day she went in and talked with the parents. She found out that he was struggling at home. And then the next time this episode happened, she asked the child, how does it feel? He says, doesn't feel good. So there's this capacity that we need to have individually, but also collectively as a culture of waiting. Skillfully, you can't just let, you know, bullying go on, but at the same time with a big heart. So how do we engage in that way? And I think when we start to engage in this what I think of as high bandwidth giving. When we think of compassion, I want to talk a little bit about compassion today. When we think about compassion, most people think of giving. I mean, that's sort of the first thought. But the first thought of giving is like a very low bandwidth way of giving. So I think of it as like, you know, this is our sympathy model of giving. I have, you don't have, and I'm going to give to you. But you can go a little deeper, and they've actually done studies on what happens, which parts of your brains are activated. When you're sympathetic, there's this very ancient part of our brain that's activated. It's very natural, and it has its values. But a deeper way, right, you go from dial-up connection to maybe a 2G or a 3G version, right, is empathy. Empathy is where you start to share in the pain. And this is a very different part of the brain that's activated. You share in the pain of other people. And you see nurses who are remarkably skilled at it. You see teachers who are remarkably skilled at it. You see many doctors that have this heart. Anyone who's working with others have this kind of capacity. But there's an even deeper way, because empathy can burn you out. Because imagine if you're taking everybody's pain on. It can be pretty intense. Empathy can burn you out, but there is this third mode of high bandwidth, fiber optic connection. Right? And that's compassion. It's sort of this kingly way of giving. You give because you have encountered this situation, and your job is to give like the rose gives its scent, unconditionally, effortlessly, because it is in its own nature. And that's a very deep way, but there's this one principle that I want to share about how what compassion recognizes. And it's a story which I actually, was one of my friend's story, but I actually heard it first here a few years ago from Bonnie. It's a story of Mother Teresa, because you look at someone like Mother Teresa and you say, wow, here's a very compassionate person. But what was her eyes? What was the lens through which she was looking at the world? So it turns out that our friend Lynn was volunteering with Mother Teresa. And it also turned out that someone was visiting. This big donor, this big financial donor was visiting, and so they took a tour of the whole place. At the end of the tour, they said, we want to take a photograph. Great. Mother Teresa says, no problem. This was before the days of selfies, so she didn't do this. But, you know, take a little photograph. And they said, well, photo was great, but it wasn't quite perfect. Can you move back? So she moves back. They take a photo again, and then they say, well, you know, actually, it's still not quite right. Can you move your head a little this way? After that second try, they go back and said, it's still not quite right. And they said, Mother Teresa doesn't really know how to pose for photos, so let me just go and move her face. So they actually moved her face. Now, if you see this person as a global icon, as my friend Lynn saw, right? She saw, for her, Mother Teresa was like this larger-than-life person. She was volunteering there, and she says, how dare you, no matter how much money you've given, how dare you, you use such an icon of compassion as an object for your photograph? And so she waits, because she sees that Mother Teresa's not saying anything, so she waits until that person leaves, and then she says, Mother, why didn't you say anything? And Mother Teresa gave her a sentence that completely transformed her. Mother Teresa says, my dear, there are many forms of poverty. Right. But the flip side of that is also true, that there are many forms of wealth. So how can you start to see life if you just say, I have stuff, you don't have stuff, I'm giving to you. I have money, you don't have money, I'm giving to you. You're actually reduced the possibility of that high bandwidth relationship to something that's like dial-up, right? Something that's really shallow for both sides. It's not a judgment on one side or the other. If you've engaged in compassion, you could never do it. You could never go back. Like, who wants to go to AOL now, right? Like, once you've seen the other side, you're like, oh, really? You know, like, it's like, you could never do that. It's like, yeah, I expect fiber optic all the time, and this is true with compassion, too. You could never go back to sympathy and empathy. So the question then becomes, if I ask myself, one of our interns asked me, and he says, well, how have you learned compassion? Right? What have been the sort of markers and stages in your journey? So I want to share a couple stories. Is there a clock here? Oh, there is, up there. All right. Take my time? Okay, you guys are stuck with me now. We got Reverend Bonnie. We got if Reverend Bonnie says take your time, we're all in trouble now. How have I learned compassion? Because I was talking to a young person, I said, well, here are the 4 years, right? Freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, and senior year. So what did I learn in my first year? So in my first year, and this is not a sequential, it's not like I'm a graduate, you know, I'm still learning. We're all still learning. And I think the moment you stop learning, something's probably wrong, right? You've probably gone back to kindergarten instead of being a freshman. But in the first year, one of the things that stands out for me is this idea that you look for opportunities to practice compassion. And initially, you're so used to the sympathy mindset that you're like, oh, this person's suffering in this way, let me help. But after a while, you start to realize that, wow, there are just so many opportunities all the time, right? So this is, and I think in the first year, what happens is some of these opportunities you take and some of these you miss. And you start looking at, why did I miss that opportunity for compassion? Because I was caught up in my own little agenda. So I remember a time, it was a really, really goofy episode. You guys are probably not going to be able to see me the same way again, but I'm going to risk it. Vulnerability. It was my wife's birthday, and she loves flowers, and so I thought, okay, I should go get her some flowers, but she also loves for me to go running, right? She's like, Nipun, you put on some pounds, man. So she says, you got to give me, you know, go exercise and all. So I was like, okay, let me feed, you know, 2 birds with the same seed. So I said, let's go running to get the flowers. Right? So I went running to go get the flowers. Now, I picked up some sunflowers, her favorite ones, and then I was like, oh, there's stargazer lilies. You know, she loves those too. Oh, what the heck? It's a birthday. Take them both, right? I didn't think too deeply about it. I just took them both. And I'm running. And I'm like on the streets in Berkeley, right? So you can imagine this Indian guy running with two bouquets, right? On the streets. So I'm sure it really stood out. But I was like, look, yeah, I know my reward's over there. I'm going to go home all sweaty, and it's going to look great. You know, my wife's going to be really happy, right? So I'm about to, so there's the door of our apartment building. I'm about to get there. I'm totally out of breath. And I'm like, yeah, I really need to run a lot more, you know, huffing, puffing. I can't wait to get to that end outcome. And there's this young girl, maybe from nearby high school. We have a high school nearby. She's walking the other way. She looks at me, and she says, oh, for me, you shouldn't have. And I was like, wow, that's pretty funny, you know, to do that in high school to a stranger. And you know, I mean, it was goofy looking anyways. And then she's like adding to it. And she says, oh, you shouldn't have done all that for me, you know. But I was so obsessed with like catching my breath that I just waited to go there. I went there. She went the other way. I kind of smiled, you know. But what would have been epic is I said, oh, no, really, it is for you. You know, I should have just given it to her. But I didn't. I missed that opportunity because I was rooted in getting there. And that sounds like a silly example, but really is because we're so fixated on a certain outcome that we miss the opportunities along the way. And there's so many of these moments that our life is filled with that I could tell you more stories, but I'll spare you with this one. I'll go to the second year. But there's another, okay, you didn't hear that. Edit that out. The second year is you realize that as you take more of these opportunities, what actually happens in that moment? You start to really connect in a very high bandwidth way. And it's really profound because we already know about certain kinds of connect. We're all related to the people we love. We're all related to people near us. But how are we related to all of life? And this starts to give us insight into that. And it can be very transformative, right? Most of you guys probably know about smile cards, and otherwise I'm sure I'll tell you about it. Where you do a small little act of kindness for somebody you don't know, and you leave a smile card behind. It says, you don't know me, but I'm just doing this to you out of love for life, and you don't need to pay back. Pay it forward. Spread the love. Do something kind for somebody else. So that sounds like a really cute idea, you know? A lot of people are like, yeah, that's great, you know? But like when I tell them, what does service-based do? You know, a lot of people are like, yeah, we do small acts of kindness, right? And then they're like, okay, yeah, what does service-based really do, you know? because this is not real, right? This is like, oh, it's cute, like nice, wonderful. But then when you actually experience it, you see how compassion really starts to connect you. Even beyond words, right? I have some photos. These are nuns that one time through a series of, it's a longer story, but through a series of different serendipities, we all somehow found ourselves at this ice cream store in Taiwan. And we were, and they had just given me a lot of money, and I was like, no, look, yeah, I can't take from nuns. My mom raised me to give to monastics. You don't like, and they said, look, yeah, our teacher said to give to you, so we're giving to you. And so we're like fighting about this in Taiwan. And this kid comes up and says, I'll take you to ice cream after the talk. And I was like, well, that's a little tempting, you know. So we're going to go, and now I have all this money. So we go to this ice cream place, and I say, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to pay for the whole line behind us. And it was a fair amount of money. I didn't actually even know how much was in there, but we just gave the envelope. And the two people behind there, you know, they're like high schoolers, and they're just, it was like, you should see their faces until we show, okay, what do you want? Yeah, you know, it's a tough job, right? Like, they were just going through the grind. And all of a sudden, like, I can't speak Mandarin, so I told my friend, this is Gwyneth. Gwyneth was there. I was like, you got to explain it. And I gave her exactly like a minute and a half notice. She's like, I don't understand it myself. Like, what is this, you know? you can't just throw this on to me. Like, how? I said, yeah, you know, hey, you've got 30 more seconds, 25, 24. So she's there. She's stuck. And she has to explain this thing. And as soon as she even starts, like the two kids behind the counter, they're just like beaming. They said, really? And then their head kicks in. First, it's their heart. So that's why they're smiling. And then their head kicks in. They ask all these questions. They figure something out. And all these people, like one of the things they forgot, I think, you know, got lost in translation is the anonymity bit. So somehow we're on that table eating our little ice cream, and all these people are like looking at us, and then they're coming to us and giving us this giant hug. No words. I didn't even know the words. I don't even know how they figured out. Maybe I was the only look. See, this is shaved ice cream. Very good. Yeah. As you heard it here at church. These are the two kids behind the counter. Really beautiful. And this is true of any single moment, right? I'll tell you one more story. This is one of my favorite stories. So this guy, he came up to me. And the reason why this is significant is when we're so biased with a certain kind of capital, we forget to see other forms of capital. So one of my friends he's a very affluent guy. And he comes up and he says, you know, which means he's a business guy, which means he's like very focused and agenda driven. He says, I don't just want to talk stories and all this stuff. I know about giving, you know about giving, let's like not even go there. What I don't know is how to receive. And so I want to get your insights on receiving. And I said, hey, yeah, great, let's have dinner. We had dinner, we talked, but you know, head stuff can only go so far. And so we had a beautiful conversation. I said, look, if you feel like you're not receiving, you're just not looking. Because it's impossible to do an act of kindness and not receive. It's just that you're so tuned into this layer that you're forgetting that there are so many different dimensions of this generosity. So he liked the idea, but I knew I had to go a little deeper. So when it was time to pay the check, I was like, let me cover your check. And he says, no, no. See, he knew that we both have bank balances. We both have a lot of zeros in our bank balances, but his has a one in front of it. So he's like, there's no way I can let you pay for this, you know? And I was like, no, it's my treat, you know? It's a wonderful thing to, and so we were like fighting, and then I said, okay, here's what we do. I'll pay for our table, you pay for somebody else's table. You know that smile card thing we talked about? That's what you get to practice right now. That was one thing, you hear it. It's another to actually do it. So the waitress comes, her name's Mandy, they start talking, and all of a sudden, Mandy's like, for first thing, right? Imagine going up and you hear this story, but actually if you do it, the waitress is the first thing she's going to say is like, what? And then she'll say, why? Right? And you have to figure out why. Your heart knows, but your head doesn't really know. Even he doesn't know. So he's like, well, actually, yeah, I think I want to spread love in the world and I want to do it anonymously. So he's like, you know, his brain is getting rewired. I could see it on his face, you know? It was like totally epic. So then Mandy asks another question, which also he hadn't thought about. He says, which table? And he's like, well, I don't know, okay, all right, yeah, I guess I have to make this up. It's like, too happy, no, medium. That, okay, that table, yeah, So he had some algorithm, you know, and he's got this confused look on his face still. Figures it out. Mandy goes there. Now, it's supposed to be anonymous, right? So you're not supposed to look over there like, I wonder what they're going to feel, you know? Like, did you smile? Can I take a selfie? No, this is none of that, right? So he's like, Mandy's over there on that table. She's explaining something to them. This guy's in front of me, but he can't resist but, like, look at the reflection in the mirror, in the window. So he's looking this side, and I'm looking at him. Because I'm trying to be more hardcore. I'm not even going to look there, you know? So I'm looking at him. He's looking there. Action's happening there. And Mandy comes back with this giant smile on her face. Because even she didn't understand how and why and all this stuff, right? But she's like, oh, my God, that was amazing. And we said, what did they say? They said, she says, they were like, do you guys do this here all the time? We're not local here. So we would love to move here if this is a regular phenomenon. And then at the end of our meal, I looked my buddy in the eye. It was the first time we were having a, you know, private dinner. And he's a very affluent person. I looked him in the eye and I said, hey, were you giving? Because he did give. He paid the financial capital. Or were you receiving? Because it was so obvious with the smile on his face that he was receiving. So you start to realize that in your sophomore year, that compassion really deeply starts to connect you. It's not just at the level of stuff, right? What Bonnie said about these things, right? She says, go out and have a conversation. It's not just giving stuff because you were given and now you're just giving that stuff. It's also what you wrap that stuff in. It's also the context, not just the content. And that's the second year's insight. The third year's insight is you realize that it's when you give stuff, usually you're giving stuff, or when you give anything, you're giving what you think the other person needs. May not always be skillful. We have this intern, and we tell him to go and do an act of kindness at an Awaken Circle, safe space. So he goes in, and he's like, yeah, you know, he just listens. But he was, like, not really actively listening. He's just there. You know, and 5 minutes later, he's still there. And I was like, no, let's go a little deeper, you know. And so we had this whole journey over the summer, and at some point he says, okay, you know what? I play the guitar. I know how to sing songs. I'm going to sing you a song. And then the week after, he says, oh, I realized that I was inflicting my favorite song onto you, as opposed to having a relationship, figuring out what you need, what you want, what would be helpful to you, intersecting it with my wisdom and seeing what's skillful. So in the third year, it's not just like, okay, I've got a hammer and everything's looking like a nail. In the third year, you become much more skillful. Right? How do you go to the heart of the situation? You want to enter into this place, you can come in through the walls, you can come in through the glass, or you can come in through the door. It's going to be much harder with the wall or the glass, right? It's going to be very destructive even. But if you find that heart, that's the door. Once you get in, you can roam around everywhere. So how do you go to every situation and find the heart of the situation? This is a guy whose story also is epic. His name is Julio. Julio works at a nonprofit organization, really nice guy. And Julio decided that, so Julio goes to work every day, comes back, he's in New York, and he takes the subway back home. As he's taking the subway back home, he usually gets off one station before and goes to his favorite taqueria. That was his ritual, 6 days of the week. And so one fine day, he gets off the, you know, subway, and he's about to go to his favorite taqueria, and on the way, this kid comes up to him, and he's like, takes out a knife. Give me all your money. Julio's like, okay, you got a knife, no problem, you know, here, you win. Here's my wallet. And the kid is about to take off, and Julio looks at him and is like, hey, kid, it's a little bit cold. Do you want my jacket too? And that kid was like, you know, first of all, he's himself a kid. And then he's like, I'm sure he's thinking, they don't teach you this in robbery 101, right? Like, what do you do? Do you go back? Or is it a trap? I mean, I don't know. Like, okay. So he's like, yeah, but he's got a kind of a nice smile on his face, you know. So he's like, okay, I'll go back. So he goes back. Yeah, actually, it is a little cold. I do need a jacket. And you've got a jacket. That's great. Yeah, my knife is powerful. He takes it, you know, he takes the jacket. And he's about to go. And Julio asks him one more question. Hey, kid, I'm about to go grab some dinner. Would you like to join me? Also, not what you learn in Robbery 101. You're like, this time he's like, maybe the first one was a bait. You know, like, this is, do I go, do I not go? But the energy between them was totally different because he wasn't like, I'm going to grab this from you. Julio had already given him everything he had. And on top of that, he's given him more. And then he's inviting him into a relationship. And so they go to this meal. And since Julio goes there all the time, he knows everybody. And this guy is having a deep conversation. And this kid's like, wow, you know, you seem like you're nice to everybody. Like, why are you like that? And he says, that's how my mama raised me. And the kid's like, well, that's not how my mama raised me. And so they had this very rich conversation. And at the end of the meal, it's time to pay the check. Julio turns to the kid and he says, you know, hey, kid, I would pay for your meal, but you've got my wallet, right? Not exactly what happened in the earlier situation. So the kid takes out the wallet, voluntarily gives it to Julio. But Julio goes one step further, and he looks at the kid and he says, hey, kid, can I ask you for one more thing? And he says, sure. He says, can I have your knife too? And the kid gives him back the knife. Now, that is not a recipe, right? If we all go out and try to do that, bad news, right? That is skillful because Julio sensed into the context, this kid sensed into his context, together they were creating a third context altogether, and in that third space, Julio says, there is where compassion can work. No NGO is going to be able to do it. No institution is going to be able to do it. No philanthropist is going to be able to do it. No group of people can be told today, go out and take everyone's knives. But Julio could do it because he sensed into the context, because he was a junior. And so in the fourth year and the final year, where this compassion goes, what looks cute, what looks small, now all of a sudden it starts revealing itself in its magnanimity. And what you see in the fourth year, now you've got this skillful, now you know it connects at a high bandwidth level, you're not missing opportunities, and you're much more skillful. Then compassion becomes courageous. Then you're ready to hold that space, to be in the center. As Rumi would say, to get cooked in the oven so that you can be bread for the world to eat. Because you take it out of the oven too soon, the timing's very important with these things. So compassion, that is courageous. Now, with courage, what we usually think of is might. We think, yeah, I'm going to go out and conquer and make this happen, right? But this kind of courage, which is born of these 3 years of practice, or these three stages of practice, this kind of courage is actually very humble. It bows before we came in here. True story today, right? Bonnie, this is why Bonnie's so amazing, is because she was the last, although she's the senior minister here, she's the last person to leave, and as we are leaving, she says, Nipun, I invite you to this practice that I do every time. I bow to the ground. And so she was bowing to all of you. She's not saying, I have got the wisdom. She surely has got the wisdom. She's surely teaching all of us, certainly me too. But she's saying, I bow. So we were on the ground in that hallway. That's humble, but it's also courageous. One of my friends was with the Dalai Lama with a group of 40, a delegation of 40. And every day in the morning, Dalai Lama would be the last person. The 40 people have assembled, Dalai Lama would be the last person to walk in. As he walks in, he noticed that everybody would bow to the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama would bow back. But as the Dalai Lama bows back, my friend noticed that the Dalai Lama would bow to different heights every single day. She says, oh, this is curious. Like, sometimes this, sometimes all the way down, sometimes, you know, it's like, what's going on? And he said, on the last day, I figured it out that what the Dalai Lama was doing when we were bowing is seeing, receiving all our bows and seeing who is bowing the lowest and then bowing lower than that person. there is that greatness in humility. And when the courage is born from that kind of a field of compassion and reverence and humility, it takes on a very different flavor. This is my friend who has a great story of how he has been trying to live into compassion, but he's not perfect. He's not like the Dalai Lama. But he says, I want to live into it in the moments that I can. So he lives in this apartment complex, and one day, as he's coming through, he had a young kid. This was happened in India. He had a young kid. I think she was probably about, you know, a year or two old at the time. And so he was just like, you know, really getting into his fatherly mode, really very protective of his family. He comes in one fine day, and he parks his car hastily. He has an assigned parking spot. But he parks it hastily, so it takes up, you know, how it takes up a little bit of the next parking spot. So the person who comes in there is like super unhappy. And so when Madhu comes in, a little later back to his car, he notices something. He notices that someone has smashed the window of his car. And he saw that the rock was right there. And he knew that he had a very difficult relationship with the neighbor whose parking spot was right there. So he was like, I know he has done this. I see his car parked outside. I see that rock. I'm feeling I need to protect my family. He takes up the rock and he says, you know, you do this to me, you're going to pay for it. And he's about to strike. And then he remembers that he's got all these friends that talk about compassion. And he's like, oh, man, like this is, can I find the courage to do something other than just react? He knew. He was at the Gandhi ashram. He knew that Gandhi had said, eye for an eye and the whole world goes blind. He knew all that wisdom, and he says, I'm still going for it. I can't stop. And then he's about to strike, and he says, okay, let me just take a deep breath. Let me just see if I can't react. Slowly, he puts the rock down. He walks up to his home, which is on the third floor. It happened to be Diwali season, and so there's a lot of different sweets that are around. On his dining table were some sweets. He's still fuming, but he says, okay, I didn't misabuse it. I mean, I didn't like take the rock and do an eye for an eye thing. But if I really had love, I would do something kind for him. And even the thought of it, he like paralyzed him, right? He's like, wow, you're really kind? Like, how can I do that? He says, there's these box of sweets. Madhu, if you've got the substance, man, you would go up there and offer them a box of sweets because it's Diwali. He had this idea. He didn't really want to do it, you know, and he's like, okay, I can do it. Okay. So the way he describes it, true story. He picks up the box of sweets. He has to go from the third floor to the fourth floor. He picks up this box of sweets, and he says it took him half an hour to climb that one flight of stairs because he just didn't want to do it. A part of him didn't want to do it, but he knew this was like the cucumber thing, right? It was growing in him. He just didn't know if he was going to make it all the way to the fourth floor. He's like, I got to keep trying. Come on, man. This is my true name. I am remembering who I am. Here, we can all be moved to tears, but in a moment like this, we really got to practice in a very deep way. And so he was like, can I remember who I am? Can I wait? He's like, you know, he goes, he knocks on the door. The guy isn't home, but his wife is home. And the way he tells the story, he says, you know, that was the extent of my compassion. So I like gave the box of sweets and ran down. Hey, happy Diwali, you know, and like, boom, like, I don't want to engage. I can't do any more of this. It took me half an hour already, you know. But that heart of forgiveness takes a lot of courage. And there is so much wrong that might have been done to us. There's so much wrong being done in the world. We're inflicting so much suffering onto other people. But an eye for an eye is going to leave the whole world blind. And so how do we start to move out of that into this deep space of courageous, humble, and yet magnanimous, yet powerful compassion? And that's when you know you're ready for grad school. For next time. And today is a special day for me. So here are the four stages. You look for opportunities of compassion. You see that compassion is connected. You see that it's not just about doing acts. It's about contextualizing that act with who you are, who the other person is, so it can be skillful. And then, born of that skillfulness, you find you engage in courageous compassion. And there are many ways to practice this. I talked to you about smile cards. There's a bunch of smile cards there. We're going to do this stuff. This is a great practice, right? I hope all of you take one. Or is it going to be given to them whether they like it or not? No. You're all going to be compassionate, okay? The cucumbers, doesn't matter. They're growing today. Many ways. Some of you in the past years have brought smile decks. I don't have them with me. Smile cards are in the back. There are these kindness booklets that we've created for a lot of people who are not virtual and they want to like actually engage in you. Every day there's a new act and you journal about it. So if you want to engage in that, and if you're seriously going to do it, this is not like a handout, and this is not a commercial thing. Nothing service-based is ever commercial. But this is not like a transaction. It's like, if you really feel that your time has ripened to really practice this, you know, this is a way to do it. It has benefited a lot of people. It's benefited me. So that may be a thing to do. But what I want to share to conclude is why this is kind of a unique day for me, because my dad is here somewhere. He's right there. That's that. Yes. There you are, right? Yes, indeed. I think this is the first time he's ever gone on a road trip with me. We've got, you know, over 2 days, there's like five events that I have. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, just come. He's staying in different houses, sleeping in different beds, doing all kinds of things, you know. This is already the third location of the day, you know. And so I hope all of you get a chance to hug him. But the reason why, inundate him. And he's totally, like, awkward about the hugs, okay? So it's going to be great. It's a sacred imperfection, right? Like you said. He's somebody that's very near and dear to my heart, both my parents. But I want to tell you about a practice they have and what I've learned from that practice. And this is the Awaken Circles that they host. We've had two Awaken Circles last two nights, but every week, my mom and dad open up their home and they say, look, it's not a fancy home. It's just an average middle-class home. But they said, we can move the furniture out to the walls and we can somehow kind of squeeze Indian rickshaw style. Whoever wants to come and sit in silence, you can have, so we have the first hour in silence. The second hour, there's a little circle of sharing where we learn from each other and you share aha moments. No teacher, no agenda, no one's trying to like, you know, convert you to anything. It's just like this space. And then the third hour, my mom said, I got to feed you, Nipun, anyway. So we started with three of us. So at that time, it was like, this totally made sense. It's like, I got to feed you anyway, so whoever else comes, I'll feed them too. Except my parents have been doing this every week for the last 20 years. My mom would have cooked herself through her own hands. Although me and my dad get some credit because we're chopping vegetables with her. But my mom would have fed about 50,000 people in our own home. And no one's asking. We've had billionaires there. You've had people who've committed a murder and spent 30 years in jail, and no one's really asking for your bio, right? You're just sitting in circle. And it's so remarkable to host in this way. But having seen so many circles, having been witness to their magnanimity, their big hearts, and they've never once, like, said, oh, they've never tried to scheme. They're not even in the center. They're totally in the background. They're just like Bonnie bowing, in a very literal way. They're just like, we're just offering whatever little we have. And it's so powerful to see what happens, and what it teaches me is that values aren't taught. They are caught. That there is this thing, and I've just seen it with so many people in front of my eyes. It's not like they're trying to teach anything. It's not that they have an agenda. And yet, when we show up in this way, with life, amazing things happen. It's slow. It could be fast also, but it's on divine time. It's not on our clock. And so when you look at it in that way, yesterday, last night, I was sharing this story. There's a guy who was here last time I was here, 2 years ago. His name is Pancho. Pancho comes in the circle, and Pancho says, as he describes it, he says, I used to be an anarchist, and now I'm Pancho 2.0, you know, because he's meditated and gone deep inside. And the first hour he did was over there. Now he has this one little practice. He goes around, and when it's his turn to share, he looks and makes eye contact with everybody. And he says, I want you to know that I love you all. that if this is the last time we make eye contact, that we meet in this way, I want you to know that I love you all. And you look at that and you say, no one's going to give you a Nobel Prize for that kind of stuff, right? Like, it's not measurable. Who even knows what ripple it has? But it's profound, because I remember, maybe about 6 years ago, I'm sure when my dad was there too, he's there every week. 6 years ago, this one woman came in to this to our circle, and she says, look, I was driving on the freeway, and as I was behind this truck, and the truck had a bunch of logs, and all of a sudden the back door of the truck opens up. And as it opens up, all the logs start falling out, and I said, oh my God, panic, I'm gonna die. What am I gonna do? She swerves, somehow manages to survive. Her car is totaled, but she was somehow in the emergency lane before she figures out the situation. In the emergency lane, she says, the thought that came to me, the first thought that came to me was,